Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Mixed Mental Arts from a rock climbing gym right near LAX. I have with me today a man that I connected through, I think we connected through Twitter, was it?
No, not Instagram.
No, because I don't really
Actually, Insta. We were listening to your podcast. We reached out about tutoring the boys.
Oh, that's right. So yeah, it was over email. Yep. Old school. And yeah, so John Aguilar. So John, I think, also represents an important transition in terms of what we're doing with the podcast, because previously we've talked about the jobocalypse and all these jobs disappearing to automation, and it's very easy to talk about these problems, but the question is, what do people do about it? How do you as the listener survive the jobocalypse? How do you transition? How are you learning, unlearning, and relearning? And then how can we help each other through this transition? And I think there may be no better person on earth right now to talk to about that than John Aguilar. So John, why don't you tell us a little bit about your story?
So I have my tradecraft is dry stone masonry, technically. So what I tell people when they ask me what I do, I now call myself a stonesmith, thanks to a friend of mine who gave me that term. But what I do is I practice the world's oldest building tradition, dry stone. That means building stone without mortar, using the world's oldest building material, stone. And so it's something I came into by accident through landscaping back in 2005. And 2008, I took a workshop out in Washington with some master masons. And I had this, I had that my aha moment doing this bridge. And it's the moment I realized that, one, I could love this trade, and two, I had the brain for it. I had the, because it requires a certain type of, a brain type, and also a certain kind of, a little bit of an OCD, but also it's very physical, one of the most physical trades out there. So, it went from kind of dabbling into it through landscaping to this aha moment, this very distinct moment with these older men, these mentors in their 60s teaching. And then from 2008 to, I would say, my business turned to where I was actually finally making good money in 2014. That's that 6-year period of trial, error, or what Seth Godin, because I love Seth Godin, what he calls the dip. He has that book out, The Dip. And that's that, that's that long dip. And then all of a sudden I got to the other side. And I'd say 2014 was a pivotal turning point in Seattle. So now we're here in Santa Barbara, and I've got this biggest project of my life out in Lake Tahoe, but it involves a big group of guys, which we'll talk about this collaboration thing.
So it's obviously a big, bold claim to say that there may be nobody better on earth to talk to about the jobocalypse than John Aguilar. And so I think I should back that up. Like, let's unpack why I think that is. And it's because, as John says, he's involved in the oldest profession other than prostitution. Yet
it's close.
It's pretty close. It's close. It's like number two. Maybe there's even some competition there. I mean, maybe stone, this dry stonework is actually older. But the interesting thing is when we talk about the jobocalypse, it's not even necessarily that these professions are going to disappear, but the nature of the profession changes so much. And what I found interesting when we were talking about this was the ways in which you're incorporating technology and in the ways in which you are separating yourself, because you can't distinguish yourself by your ability to do the routine work or do the routine work faster. You distinguish yourself by your ability to use the three C's.
Yeah. And so as we talk, we're definitely going to go, it's going to feel tangential to the audience, and then always ask me those probing questions, because the trajectory from what I call the aha moment, which actually is based on the Strength Finders book, which I'll talk about. It's not a straightforward path that I set out. I kind of listed out, but it happened. I think the best way to describe it, it came off a mindset. So I was in the Marine Corps, and then I went back with the GI Bill and finished my degree up in my 30s. So I've done, I've done the military thing. I've done the Bachelor of Arts thing, and didn't have any course laid out for me. So I think it's important, as we talk about this, for the coherency of this conversation, just to ask me clarifying questions. But
well, that's my job.
Yeah, yeah, that, of course. You know,
there's an old joke. Or Katie O'Brien uses this metaphor. So in improv comedy, I think it's at UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade. They say that any great improv has three different characters. So there's pirate, robot, and ninja. And so pirate is what Brian Callen does. He sort of swashbuckles into the conversation and just shakes everything up. And now where the hell are we? You know, Joe Rogan is very much pirate. There's a lot of pirate. Yeah. Robot is really what I do. It's what Will Sasso does in the 10-minute podcast, where you're shaping the narrative. And it is that you're constantly restructuring everything. And then there's Ninja, which is what Chris D'Elia does, where he sits, he hangs back.
And then just jumps in.
Bam! He just has some great line that he throws in, or, you know, really like hits the nail on the head. So my job is to be the robot.
Gotcha.
So I'm going to help shape the narrative. And yeah, I think to that end, I think there are a lot of really great things in terms of what you're talking about, where there was no defined path for you. And I don't think there's a defined path for anybody anymore. The old ways of, you know, oh, I'm going to go to high school, I'm going to do well in high school, and then I'm going to go and major in this very specific thing in college, and then I'm going to go and have this career for 40, 50 years working for some company or working as a doctor. It doesn't work like that anymore. There's this constant disruption. All this technology is coming along. And so there's this need to constantly improv and be figuring out a path for yourself. What is your path?
Yeah, no, that's huge. I would say the start, like step one, was when my wife has this amazing ability to feed these books to me. And the first book she kind of fed to me, and I use that word because I'm great at reading the books and applying the knowledge. The first one was the Strength Finders test, and that's the Gallup organization. So it's written by Tom Rath. I took their test back in 2007, and it gives you your five top strengths, and that's based off of positive psychology. But the book is brilliant. And what happened is when I saw what my five top strengths was and how I could use that as a kind of a tool in, you know, to move forward, I immediately applied. One of them was learning. I'm an avid learner. So I did these contractor trainings up in British Columbia, and then I did this workshop with these Masons. So I'd say like the application of that book put me into mental framework that I also kind of drug in a bunch of stuff I learned from the Marine Corps. And I started kind of creating my own, you know, my own perceptions or my own mindset, my own ethics, my own discipline. I kind of put it down on paper, put it mentally in my, you know, and that's what drove me forward. And I was in the trades, and I wanted to really become this craftsman. And then when I realized dry stone, this very obscure world that most people don't understand stone, architects, designers don't understand it, let alone the old tradition. And so what I added to that over the years with all these other books and podcasts and TED Talks with Seth Godin and blogs was constantly refining. You know, it's kind of like bringing an intellectual bent into what some people call it the blue collar world. I think craftsmen and artisans should be more defined. So I always try to use different rhetoric, vernacular, when talking about these guys, but brought a lot of refinement in, which was, you know, kind of an intellectual thing. So I, over the years, I even changed how I spoke to clients, which verbs and nouns, instead of saying, hey, I'm a contractor, you know, we're going to do this job, I would talk to them about, you're hiring a craftsman, you're commissioning me for a stone project, a stone installation. And what it does is, I found it triggers.
Of course.
It triggers a different mentality. Because a pedophile can be a contractor. Anybody can be a contractor. It's super easy. You like that?
The great thing about putting anything on the internet is that there's always a smorgasbord of reactions, and who knows what that comment's going to trigger.
Well, so, there's very little, especially like say in places like Colorado.
Yeah.
There's no contractor testing, and even what California with all its regulation, it's still not really a vetting process.
Yeah, it's the same thing as tutoring, where if a pedophile can be a tutor, that's much more disturbing and much more problematic. But with tutoring, what regulations are there? What controls are there? And in practice, there's a huge range in how people approach tutoring. Many people just come in and essentially they enable the student. So the student isn't doing their homework, they're not studying, they're not teaching themselves, and then the tutor comes in and solves their problem and like really is just like either just tells them the answers and does the work for them, or so thoroughly breaks down the problem for them that they're not really actually learning how to learn. They're really just being spoon-fed how to do this particular topic. And then there's what Katie and I do and what some other tutors do, where it's like, my job is to put myself out of a job. I'm training wheels. If you still need me in 5-6 years, I am not doing my job. So my job is to push you towards greater and greater independence all the time so that you're taking more and more charge of this academic process and are teaching yourself. Because, I mean, so for example, I was talking with a student this morning who I've worked with for long enough now that I am really unhelpful, incredibly unhelpful, where rather than breaking these things down for them, I'm like, okay, what don't you understand? And they're like, I don't understand this. And I'm like, great, let's Google that. What does it say? Okay, now break down that explanation. What does that mean? What do you have to do? Great. And that's the stage that you reach. And at a certain point, there's no point in them even needing you anymore, because they realize that actually all along I could have been teaching myself this material. So there's a huge range within tutoring. There's a huge range between, say, a contractor and a stonemason or a craftsman.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that distinction, which you're going to find across professions, really comes down to, what are your motivations? Are you just trying to clear some hurdle to get some cash right now, motivation 2.0, or are you motivation 3.0? Are you really engaged in autonomy, mastery, purpose? Are you trying to be of service? Are you trying to always push yourself to higher and higher levels?
Yeah, so that actually is a great little segue, because that's that's been part of this constant refinement process. And so always asking those questions, you know, and those come through books, and those come through failure at a project. I mean, one of my pivotal moments was in 2010. I got this project using quartzite. Never used quartzite stone before, and it's one of the, on a Mohs scale, it's 7 out of 10, one of the hardest ones. But it's a particular stone a client wanted, and I was doing this geometric circular complex layout, and it took me forever. And I didn't have, you know, a lot of the struggles that I think craftsmen and artisans really have, especially a lot of dry stone masons, is how to price, because what we do takes so much longer than what traditional masons use. They're who use in phony stone or cut stone or mortar. And it's very subjective. And so I found this to be a common struggle. It's not really a struggling artist thing, but it's really a struggle about how to price fairly so that you can live. Right?
And also to educate your clients, because I would think that most of them aren't smart enough to know the difference between the sort of the cut rate fake stone stuff and the real deal.
Absolutely. And then, you know, the other thing is a lot of us will give what we call a multi-generational or 100-year warranty. Because in dry stone, you know, you're building things that to last forever. And that's most of the greatest wonders in the world are dry stone. And so that's one of the things dry stone masons are after, is to create these, build these projects following the, we call them the sacred rules, the old rules, so that it lasts for 100, 200 years. I call it a 100-year warranty. But, you know, you do have to explain, you have to teach, and you have to be patient with the client. Some people have, you know, they call you for a concrete patio, and to talk them into dry stone 3 times, 4 times the cost, 4 times the schedule or the timeline, you know, it takes a lot of work. But people love stone. They're, you know, dry stone's magical. So,
and just to clear up what dry stone means, what can you unpack that for us?
That's probably a good point there. Dry stone is building stone, anything, stone works, stone features without the use of mortar.
So examples would be Machu Picchu, the pyramids at Giza, a lot of the greatest wonders of the world, as you said, and specifically because there's no mortar between the blocks of stone.
Yeah. And so, And so there's still actually quite, I mean, it's surprising. Instagram really, Instagram, Facebook, there's so many groups of these guys. They're all over the world. But, you know, it's a, this tradition's probably strongest in Ireland, Scotland, England, North Canada, and the U.S. But, yeah, there's still quite a thriving group of dry, guys will call them dry stone masons, dry stone wallers, et cetera. But, yeah, the key is that there's no mortar used. And so the design process is completely different than what people mostly see, which is, you know, stuff slapped up on a wall, good or not good, with mortar. It's completely different method. It's completely different cost, timeline, amount of materials. It's just, it's long, it's arduous, but the return value, it's powerful. It's magical. I mean, there's a reason why people have what I call these, you know, little moments of awe around dry stone, and they don't know how to explain it. But when they're around it, and that's why you see Machu Picchu, all these things constantly up on magazines, and there's an attraction.
It's primal.
It's very primal.
And I think it's, I had this conversation with Chris Ryan, actually the episode that's going to be on Mixed Mental Arts. It will have posted by the time this one does. But all about how a lot of the people who are most looking forward are actually looking back. There's this real look back to what was tribal, what was primal, those old rhythms. What can we learn from hunter-gatherers? How were they organizing their societies? How did they treat the elderly? How were they eating? How were they living their lives? How were they? I mean, a lot of what Katie and I are doing is paleo education, because the way that education was done in a tribe is through stories. And so all of this science need to be turned into stories that can be really transmitted and easily passed along.
Well, that's okay. So that's cool. You said that, because the new, and we'll get into this as the conversation goes along. So this new consortium I formed off kind of an anticipation of what's forthcoming post recession 2008, what's coming in, what, you know, looking at the way the economy's moving, the way the class, you know, the Uber class versus the diminishing of the middle class is happening. I put all these things into this context, and this is one of the strengths I found. Through the Strength Finders test, the future is strength. And so I formed this consortium 2016. It was an idea I had 8 years ago, had to shelve it for timing purposes. But it's just like what you just said. My tagline is ancient stonecraft meets modern design. I worked with all the members of my consortium. They're all craftsmen and artisans. We spent 2 weeks trying to figure out how to message that, but it's exactly what you just said. It's how do we bring the world's oldest trade, the oldest building material, the method that's most magical, how do we bring it? So that's our tagline. And it's looking back at that and how do we bring it into a modern context? And that's, it's a constant process. And so this current project we have in Tahoe is a massive experimentation of that very kind of the meaning of that tagline.
And I think a great example of that was you were talking about the guys who are using this massive laser. We're talking about the atomic clock and the tunnel that they built. And would you mind unpacking that for us a little bit?
Yeah, I have to... It's one of those non-disclosure projects.
Oh, okay. But we're not going to talk about that.
Well, basically, I'll tell you about these guys. Jason Stewart, there's they're polymaths. They're geniuses. They're up in Seattle called Seattle Solstice. These guys they build their own machinery in this massive warehouse, and they do things to stone that would blow your mind. And I always say it's alien-like. When I go in there, I feel like diminished in my... who I am in capacity, but these guys are they're so just amazing, you know, gene polymath guys. And they build all these machines. And so they're doing some abstract geometric sculptures for our project, but they are involved with this project. It's via the long, I think the organization is called longnow.org. It's ongoing, but these guys have done something we're pretty sure that's not been done in the world before. It's a diamond blade that cuts into the ground sideways these stairs, and it's hard to describe. But so these guys are also of this kind of same mindset as working with this oldest material with with emerging technology that they create and adapting. And so they position themselves to be what I'm pretty sure there's only like two or three companies in the world that have their capacity, right? And so these guys are part of this consortium. I don't think I can go into the project any more than that.
No. But I think the main thing there is that it is a great example of how you're working with the old, world's oldest mm-hmm. building material, but taking advantage of the latest technology.
Yeah.
And that is, I think what I love about your story is that I think it's a really good exemplar of, and this is why I say that you're the best person to be talking mm-hmm. about this. This really happens for you. You made a shift in how you were approaching the job that you were doing, aged 40, and you're in the blue-collar, in inverted commas, jobs, which are not the ones where we tend to think about innovation or automation, and you're having to redefine and reframe what you're doing to distinguish it from the pack, because you are approaching it from, you're delivering a higher quality product, you are approaching it from autonomy, mastery, and purpose, motivation 3.0. So when we think about the jobocalypse, it's not that you necessarily were all going to be computer programmers. It can be that you are just approaching what you're already doing in a new way and with fresh eyes and constantly looking to improve and evolve what you're already doing.
Yeah. And I had this, the other thing to throw in there, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? That's interesting. I've never thought about that way.
I stole that from Daniel Pink. Oh, okay. It's in his book, Drive.
Okay, so back in 2009, I believe, I read Richard Florida's book, The Rise of the Creative Class. Fantastic book. I think he's like an urban theorist, an urbanist, a sociologist. So he has a website, The Creative Class. I read his book. I think that's where I created this. I think he either articulated like the three C's or I kind of compiled them out of there. But from that time, 2009, I realized the way to move forward, because I love the physicality of being a dry stone mason. I mean, I love the physical work. It's a thinking man's game. I bring my particular artistic flair to it. We all follow all the excellent dry stone masons. We all follow the same rules. You can't break the rules, but we all bring our own distinct flair or style or joinery style into it. But these three C's I was talking to you about before were, if you're in the creative field, creativity, collaboration, communication, those can't really stand alone, but put together, if it becomes like a platform, that's kind of the way I describe it. I started just thinking about it, reading. We don't watch TV. We haven't had TV since 2012, so that opens up.
You haven't
up.
Been missing out on much.
Yeah, yeah. Think about how much time that opens up for me to read, to apply, to think, and come up with new. I've always been a yes guy. I say yes sometimes before thinking, but I find it serves me well because it puts me in a stress position, and then we're built off. We're designed to be stress adaptive. Is that the word? Yeah, adaptive. And so I've put myself with my work, my trade, into highly stressed situations I had to adapt to. But I also knew I could. But it was an on-the-job training for myself, and the delivery was never anything less than the highest possible execution. That's kind of like the Marine Corps mentality of, no matter how little gear you have, mission first. There's this this idea that, you could lose all your gear, all your equipment, but you still got to accomplish this mission, right? And so I would put myself into these projects without really understanding how I was going to do it. And I'd go through this painful process in the beginning, some stress. And by the end of that 4 month, 6 month, whatever, the outcome would be fantastic, gorgeous. And so these three C's, I still kind of not preach them, I still share them with people, where I'm in a creative field. And I actually believe in what I tell all the members of the consortium, I believe the creative class has a unique position in the emerging economy. I think Richard Florida says it's the new economy. We went through information, and now the creative class is rising, centered around urban areas. And so I'm like, okay, I'm in the creative field. How do I take this? How do I treat this more like a business? How do I refine it? So then from there, it was this belief that collaboration is the way forward. And I started just figuring out how to collaborate in every possible manner, right? And really getting out of this mindset of scarcity, out of this mindset of individuality, and realizing my mind, my how I brought my artistic flair to a project will always be mine. I don't have to worry about someone taking that or capturing that. So I started doing all these different, you know, reaching out to guys and collaborating with other guys for big projects. And then I further applied to that communication where whether I'm emailing, texting, phone calling, or one-on-one to an architect or designer, really polishing my communication delivery, which is still a process. I mean, all the way down to my punctuation and grammar, because I have this weird thing like, if I don't edit my text or I don't edit my email to an architect, and I'm talking about the world's oldest building trade with the sacred rules, and they see edits, there's a subconscious connection between that and some crappy work.
Mm-hmm.
Does it make sense?
Well, if you're doing crappy work in the email, then it just says something about your attention to detail. It's a total process and a total experience. And have you seen? You may have missed out on this because you've been TV free since 2012. Yeah. But have you seen Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
No. The
documentary.
Yeah, on Netflix.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's just a great example. What this approach that you're using in terms of dry stone work, it can be applied to anything, right? I've applied it to my own tutoring. I'm beginning to apply it to this podcast because I'm like, okay, if we really want to move these ideas, then we really need to grow this thing. We really need to constantly be improving. I have to figure out Instagram, so on and so forth. But it's, and of course, Jiro applies it to sushi. And it's the attention to detail of all parts and constantly iterating it. And Jiro is, in the documentary, I think he's 80 years old. And he's still having epiphanies. I just love that there's this great moment in the documentary where he's like, we're still figuring out things about octopus. Like there are levels of octopus and how we're going to massage the octopus and for how long that are still being uncovered. And so if it doesn't really matter what field you're in, I think is the crucial thing. It's how you're approaching it. And then what is the emotional experience that you're having around it? Is it an experience of scarcity and fear and just trying to do the minimum amount to get paid? Or is it the experience of throwing yourself into the work and understanding that we all are members of the creative class? And how are you constantly evolving the process to get better and better?
Yeah, and that's, I get the guys who are out there trying to, they're trying to feed their family. I mean, I was there too, but I realized at one time if one attention to detail is lacking, it's lacking all across the board in this country. So that's an easy way to rise above the competition. That's an easy one. But this changing the mindset. So I had to do a lot of work on myself. I'd say if some millennial or someone were to ask me, the elevator pitch, we got one floor to go, what do I do? I said, work on yourself, because, I had to change my mind, my perception, my mental attitude, take extreme ownership, like Jocko talks about, full responsibility for everything, every outcome, no matter what, never blaming the stone, never blaming the tool, never blaming a poor plan or I didn't know. And that, that takes a lot of work but I adjusted, fire. I used that term before. Real quickly, because it hurts when you're working your butt off and you end up coming out to like $7 an hour because you did bid, right? Versus time and material. So in our world, the next time I get a bid, I'm not going to screw up like I did last time because you can't survive on $7 an hour, And so what I wanted to get back to is this, what you talked about before is in this emerging economy, what I've told all the what I believe, and this is just me looking into the future, all the input I've taken from James Altucher's report, Seth Godin, I love Seth Godin, Richard Florida, all these guys, all these books I've read, and then just looking at the landscape out there, and then my experience. I've worked in Seattle, Colorado, so I've worked in the big cities, Southwest Colorado, now out here and, worked in Silicon Valley, now at Lake Tahoe. And what I believe, and this is my, it's not a hope, and it's not just optimism. It's a belief that the guys in the, especially craftsmen, anybody in the creative class, because that's, you're really bringing yourself out through that art. It's not something that can be stolen and automated. I mean, we know that for a fact, right? But as we have this, I don't know if the right word stratification, but as we have the uber wealthy, that group grows, and then you have the diminishing of the middle class, and then you have more of a lower class. Someone still has to serve. You can say that's a bad choice of verb, but the uber wealthy, right? They still want things built. They have houses. They still want the best materials. They still want the best design, right? And so, you know, I've told all the guys, I've got blacksmiths, woodworkers, lighting team, sculptor, all these guys are members of this consortium. And I said, I believe that we are positioning ourselves, if we do things at the highest level possible, to be in a middle class future for ourselves. Like, I don't think we have to worry other than we do the necessary worry project to project as far as how we design and build and perform. Like, there's always that stress to each project is, it's like the last, that's it. That one, how well you do that one determines the next one. That's just accepted, right? But I do believe we are positioning ourselves to be the new middle class.
You're talking about a leap of faith here. The leap of faith between being the guy who's just trying to survive and just trying to get through things to deciding that you're going to be the kind of guy who is going to just always be pushing to do more excellent work. And the faith that if you are constantly pushing your own game and raising the bar on yourself, that people will find you, that work will find you. And that is an act of faith. The switch from motivation 2.0 to motivation 3.0 is a leap of faith. And I have had to repeatedly make that leap of faith. And it was a leap of faith when I moved out here and started tutoring and was like, I'm not just going to be a tutor who is essentially a journeyman tutor who is doing whatever their job and they just want their paycheck and they're trying to create dependency. And so pushed and pushed and pushed. And
well, that's why we actually reached out to you initially, because we wanted, since we homeschool, we wanted not subject specific tutoring for the boys. We wanted something like we call it force multiplier effect. And we got that, you know, listening in to your podcast. And that's why we reached out, because we wanted something that's like mastery level.
Yeah.
So, I mean.
And people know that. Yeah. There are people, the more savvy people know and can spot the difference. And they recognize that although the field may be different, that the mindset is the same, the attitude is the same. And I think that's the key thing, that the more of us make that leap to motivation 3.0, the greater the demand for that is going to be. Because as people who have adopted that motivation 3.0 mindset succeed, then what will happen is that people will copy that. They'll see, oh, John Aguilar, look what John Aguilar is doing in stone. We have to copy him because he's like the Apple computers of stone. And we want to be like that. And we want to be craftsmen. And that's how the tide of ships is raised, is through awe and trying to copy people who are really doing things and really doing things well. But to your point as well about who's secure in the jobocalypse, Picasso is not going to be put out of a job. Because Picasso is an artist, and because Picasso does something that is always pushing for mastery and pushing to greater and greater levels. Are there going to be robotic sushi restaurants? Potentially. But Giro is not going to be put out of business, because Giro is a craftsman. He's an artist, and he's constantly pushing to higher and higher levels. And what he delivers is he delivers experiences.
Well, two interesting things. So one for the audience. So yes, it was a leap of faith what I did with this consortium, and it is a leap of faith what we're doing with this. We have the biggest project, 500,000 pounds of stone. We start May 1st in Lake Tahoe. So it's a very unique project, because it's a very unique situation with very unique parameters. So I had to create this model ahead of time for how do we achieve the highest level of kind of outdoor arts installation landscape for this guy's house in a very limited, probably one quarter of the time frame that typical, and also with all the restrictions in this association. So it is an experiment. It's in the works. We're 9 months into this. But beyond the leap of faith, my finances have changed over the last 2 years. So I'm finally able to support the family in a meaningful way since 2014, but it began with these unique shifts that, you know, so I did the dip, what Seth Godin calls a dip. I did the hard work, laid the foundation from 2008 with a mind shift, took a good solid 6 years. This stuff doesn't happen overnight. I mean, it's hard work, but I loved what I was doing, right? And then all of a sudden, the dip ended and I'm on the other side. That's 2014. And then all of a sudden, it was a matter of how big do you want to grow? Not company-wise, because I don't have employees. I use apprentices, and I also use payroll services because we're project to project. So I also looked at how to avoid overhead costs. I rent all my big machinery, or I rent out other contractors. So there's all these little things to keep me what I call lean and mean, and also to keep my brain free of administrative tasks. I didn't want that, because if my brain's free of all payroll and maintaining equipment in a yard, then I'm not into the next job, because I'm always thinking of the next project, right? I got to have that space free. So the cool thing about everyone listening is that I'm making more money now as a dry stone mason. And I've had to take on different hats than I've ever could have dreamed of. And I'm not kidding you. I'm not going to say how much, but it definitely was not just the leap of faith and the actualization of this structure. It's paying off right now.
Yeah.
But that's not when I let my guard down either. Now I have to get even more disciplined. I have to apply more of these rules to myself. So it's not like I sit back.
And I think it's also, in terms of, I think what's interesting is the degree to which your experiences in the Marine Corps have a large part of it is that there's been a long, slow hunch for you of understanding that mindset that you had in the Marine Corps, where stress is something that you adapt to and that you respond to and you just deliver. And then at a certain point, as you embrace that, there becomes a stage at which you suddenly are enjoying being out of your depth. You're enjoying the discomfort. You're enjoying not entirely knowing how you're going to solve this problem.
That's that term I told you about last time, embrace the suck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So break down embrace the suck. I mean, it's pretty intuitive.
Well, yeah, yeah.
a lot of Marine Corps terms.
Yeah,
but.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, we used to say, I was in 88, 92, and they still use it to this day. And I think they've made some enhancements on it. But embrace the suck it's really great, actually, because it's usually in the military, it's more about your environmental conditions, so when it's like, the middle of the night and you're in Camp Lejeune, or you're in the swamps up to your thighs, or you're in the desert, it's really when the environment's really arduous, over the top arduous, to where you just, most people are like, I'm out of here. You don't get an out. So the way you get out of misery, we always had this other one, misery loves company, but to top that one, to top that one is you just fully go out and embrace the suck. Whatever the environmental situation could be, sleeting, and you just kind of like bring it on. You're just like, you're like, fuck you, bring it on, embrace the suck.
I love this.
And then what happens is there's kind of a shift, and you begin to kind of almost, I wouldn't say thrive, that's probably reaching way out there, but you have a different mental perception. Instead of it breaking you down and degrading you moment by moment, especially when you're cold and wet, that's the worst combo, then you start to kind of almost smile, so that was like embrace the suck. And then as a dry stone mason, you have a lot of embrace the suck days. I've worked in the snow, sideways snow, sleet, no tent over the top, and you're still, you're on a schedule. So when you have those days, I have a 70-30 rule. 70% of the days I hope are great, and 30% I inevitably believe are going to suck. So all I know is like 70% of each day and 30% of each day is like that. 70% of the duration of the project and 30% of it will be awesome and then absolutely suck. And then it's not like a surprise. Does that make
right.
sense?
You've prepared yourself. You have realistic expectations.
Yeah.
And also, crucially, nothing is more satisfying than, I'm sure, being out there on a shitty day with sleet and you're working hard and the stone. And then it, A, makes you really appreciate getting inside and getting warm. Mm. And then also it makes you appreciate the good days all the more.
Well, here's what's cool about dry stone. So when you as a dry stone mason, wherever you are in the world, you know, there's these old sacred rules, and there's pretty much a standard set of sacred, what we call sacred rules of how you build that have never, you just don't break them. So no matter, this is what I love, no matter what the condition. So that last project I did, the Colorado Moongate project, we had every kind of weather you can think of out there, but no matter what the conditions were, I could have been mentally just miserable that day. As long as I did the rules correctly and how I set the stone, my end stone or my foundation stone or my capstone, whatever that was, as long as I just followed the rule, the environment can't affect the outcome. It cannot affect it. So my stonework for that day of misery will be just as spectacular as the day when it's 80 and sunny. Does that make sense?
You have a process, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you have standards, and you have a way of doing things. But I think, John, it's important that you recognize something in this moment, which
What's
is that?
That
you just created a T-shirt.
Oh,
I'm pretty sure that when Matt Madonna and Nicole Page, aka Team Unicorn, listen to this podcast, that Embrace the Suck is going to become a Mixed Mental Arts T-shirt.
She did. Yeah.
It's a pretty That's amazing awesome. T-shirt. Misery Loves Company is also great. And then the other one that I really appreciated in terms of our last conversation, you dropped it in here briefly, is Adjust and Fire.
Or Adjust Fire.
Adjust Fire, yeah. So could you break that one down for us?
Yeah, because you know, a lot of these have applicability to the civilian sector, we call it, which I'm now part of. So Adjust Fire is when you're calling artillery in, and you know, the first artillery round, so you have someone who's like a forward observer, or they're calling in the artillery rounds, and if it's not on target, you know, say it's 100 yards off, you adjust fire. So you're relaying commands back to the artillery guys, and they're adjusting, they're walking that round in until they hit the target. So that's adjust fire, and that's what, you know, that's, it's a great term, because, you know, especially what I've had to do is I know what my objective was over the last few years, and you don't wait for that perfect, everything to be perfect so you can hit the target, because it's probably not going to happen. But by firing your first round, taking that first step, doing that project, you know, that project in 2010, I was way off target in terms of my bid time and my price. But my objective, which is to build this quartzitic, you know, geometric fire pit system, was there, right? But I had to call, I had to adjust fire constantly to get on. But that didn't happen until the next project when I did my bids correctly. And I said, oh, I've worked quartzitic stone. I now realize I have to spend $3,000 on blades or whatever that was. So there's a lot of that. And it's just a great, it kind of eases the stress of this, like, I've got to have it perfect the first time. It's not going to be.
Well, and in the military, the big difference between the military and the civilian sector is that in the military sector, firstly, you know, you can't not fire, mm-hmm. right? You have to take a shot, mm-hmm. because you're under fire, and if you don't return fire, unless you're a sniper, there you go. But you know, so there's no, a lot of people never fire in their lives. They never take that first shot. And so I think it is a great metaphor in the sense that it's the scientific mindset. The scientific mindset is experimental. You do something, you see how the world reacts, and then you refine your experimental design based on whatever feedback you get, or it's improv comedy. And that's what's interesting. You know, you throw something out, you see how the other person reacts, and then you adjust.
When you do those T-shirts, by the way, you know how you do attributions at the bottom?
Yeah.
Just say -USMC.
Well, and specifically, is it your unit, right?
No, and this is just a Marine Corps term.
Oh, is Embrace the Suck is across the Marine Corps.
Yeah, so okay. just attribute it.
Make sure that they get the credit.
Just it's USMC at the bottom. On all those.
Yeah, absolutely. absolutely. But now what I'm also really excited is that the Navy boys and the Air Force and the Army and the Coast Guard are going to be throwing theirs in.
Yeah.
We're going to start getting international divisions. You know, other people's armies are going to be throwing theirs in. And that's good. That's what we want. We want competition.
Yeah.
And we want a little sibling rivalry. And that's how we all get better.
Yeah.
So, but what's so great is that what you've done here is, this is just all a great example of idea sex, where you are bringing together, there's your experiences in the Marine Corps, there's all of these books from people like Seth Godin and James Altucher, and then there's also your, what was your day job,
Yep.
And you have brought them all together and you're constantly using them, plus all this technology of these, you know, extremely high-end diamond cutting tools. And you're just constantly refining that all together and also collaborating with blacksmiths to evolve better and better things than we've ever seen before.
So that's a really, I'm glad you brought that up, the idea six, because I'd like to give an example. So I'll just say there's, you know, seven of my top books, right, or in websites. So I'm going to just explain. So Strength Finders, the first book I read, gave me my five top strengths, right? And I applied them immediately. I went into work like, how do I do it? Well, one of the important things is I learned a long time ago to cultivate. There's this guy on Tim Ferriss. I can't remember who it is, but he says he cultivates empty space, right? So it's not meditation. Meditation doesn't work for me, but I purposely cultivate empty space because I have this kind of belief that within emptiness lies the creative, that's like the seed of creativity. And if there's constant bombardment of input like that without empty space, especially as a craftsman, how do you come up with your new idea, right? So, you know, I took these strengths, I began applying them. Then this other fantastic book, Three Simple Steps by Trevor Blake, he's a British businessman. Man, that was about how to be intentional as a business person. I mean, like sitting down in empty space and writing these out from a future tense, right? Very, very a practical book. Not this woo-woo book. You know, well, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't the secret thing where if you think long enough, you're going to get that car. This is about,
but that works, John. It does. If you really, if you didn't get the car, it's because you didn't dream hard enough.
Exactly. you know, so there's all these, you know, The War of Art by Stephen Pressfield.
This is a great book.
Former Marine, by the way.
Oh, is he really?
Yep. I'm not going to let you forget that part.
And I don't think we should. I think there's it's
resistance, man.
Yeah, it teaches you to thrive and survive and to struggle and to work through all these things.
Yeah, his book is a go-to. I read that probably once every 3 months. Austin Kleon, this guy, I think he's in Texas. Show Your Work is one book, Steal Like an Artist.
Yeah, Steal Like an Artist.
Yeah, so my wife got that for me in Seattle, and that's when, after reading his books, that's when I decided to make my presentation. So when I went to a client's house, I dressed differently. I stopped showing up in contractor gear, and I started saying, hey, you're talking to a craftsman, and you're commissioning me for work. I use these terms because I wanted them to perceive me different for what my capacity or my capability was. So his books, I mean, that's when I took, I told you about this black paper with white gel pen. So instead of doing like a pencil sketch on white paper, I would do sketches. I'm a great sketcher. I would do three, you know, these sketches for them of my ideas, white gel ink on black. It popped out. And then people loved it. And, you know, I told you the other story about how I landed this massive project. I wrote my idea of, this came from Austin Kleon, so I give him props on this. I said, what's authentic to me? Well, authentic to me is sometimes I like handwriting. So for this massive project I'm on right now, I actually wrote a 4-page letter to them on black fiber paper in cursive about my vision for their project. I described it to them I called it a journey. And when I went out to visit these guys, they flew me out to their home, Lake Tahoe. They had that on the kitchen table. This is a 7-figure project. And I'm like, how cool is that? Is that just being it's what I felt in the moment was how I wanted to, what's the word? You know, it's like how I wanted to be. I didn't want to do a standard like bunch of plan sets. I just felt that's not what this was about. I went with my intuition. And so,
I think this also gets to a great point about rich folks, which Chris Ryan made to me, which is that so much of what rich folks end up paying for is isolation. They pay to live in these big gated communities. They pay to live in these giant houses. They pay to have sort of secluded getaway retreats. And then they wonder why they're lonely.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what's interesting is that when you are then doing things that feel very personal and intimate, and when you start demanding respect from them, which is not a thing that most people don't demand respect from the wealthy and the powerful, and when you are then doing personal things like writing a personal letter, handwritten in cursive that really shows that you've thought. And that's so much of what sets you apart, because they're lonely. Rich folks is lonely.
Well, and you know, there's definitely some veracity to that, especially you go out to North like Tahoe area. And so, you know what, the other thing too is I message to everybody I work with, all these craftsmen, is we also are in this unique opportunity. I've got a client who really trusts me as the project director and the stonesmith, but he's also allowing us to bring our highest design and material possibility to him. And so everything we're designing for him is one off. It'll never be duplicated again. He loves that. But he's also really trusting. But what I've told everyone is, you know, don't, you know, look at this guy as he's commissioning us. He's a patron. And so there's a lot of gratitude that's messaged within our group about, regardless of what his background is and the situation, et cetera, et cetera, we're in this rare moment. We hope it happens again. And so, you know, I just conjure this message up as, let's be grateful to him and his position, and he's willing to lay out this money for us to bring our collaborative best effort and our individual selves to this project.
And to make art. Exactly. Very much in the vein of the way that the Medicis or the Popes sponsored Da Vinci and Michelangelo, their patrons. And I mean, the people who have paid me to tutor have been my patrons. They've allowed me to read all of these books, take all this time, break down these ideas to then figure out how do you move them much farther. And that is something you should be grateful for, because it offers you that space, that creative space that you're talking about, in which to explore what is the next thing for you. How are you evolving to the next stage? And I think this is a good moment in which to tie back as your personal robot. How do we, that word serve, the idea of service. And I think that the interesting thing is that, Chris Ryan and I talked about this part of this hearkening back to this old tribal way of living, is that it's, if you think about that tribe of 150, what makes people happy and fulfilled is serving the tribe.
Absolutely.
And helping each other. And that's a very basic human need. And he specifically talked about this word embeddedness, being embedded within a community. And I think that it's not just that the middle class serve the rich people. It's that the rich people are lonely. They desire the opportunity to serve and be useful. They desire the opportunity to be embedded.
Yeah.
And they've sort of backed themselves into this weird hole of living in these McMansions, and they're not happy very often. Some of them are.
Yeah.
But the ones who are happiest are the ones who are the most embedded and who approach their own work and their own wealth from the perspective of being of service to humanity. So I think ultimately, this is what's interesting, is that we all find ourselves in these different positions in societies, but we all have the same basic primal human desires for embeddedness, for community, for being of service, for being useful, for autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Well, that's along with the service aspect, because in the end, if you're a tradesman, a craftsman, you're serving. I mean, it's just an acceptance in serving to me as a man. I have four kids. I've got a grandkid coming on. That's like, to me, that's one of the higher, you know, that's why guys go in the Navy SEALs. That's why people go in the military. People do different, because most men want to serve in some capacity. Tutoring, essentially that's serving someone's growth. So I think service has, it's been, unfortunately, it was relegated to a lower kind of pedestal, and now there's an opportunity for us to bring it back to its rightful place and look at it with respect, right? And so that's what, you know, this consortium, I'm going to go back to the consortium, is we're in the, you know, the design of the consortium, I have seven members, they're all distinct craftsmen, we're in service to each other for the greater good. That's the collaboration. But we're also in service of our craft, in service to a client, right? So it's this kind of perfect circle that brings in the collaboration aspect and the outcome. I could never have intentionalized or planned for the outcome as it is right now. It was definitely a process. And so the one thing I want to make sure we discuss, we talked about this before, is the apprenticeship. So this is another service thing that I've thought about. So 2 years ago, I brought on an apprentice for the Colorado Moongate project, and I ever since then I had this idea of especially young men, you know, late teens, early 20s, besides the military, besides going in debt for school, what is out there? What's offered to them? Not much, right? And yet there's this, you know, if you follow Mike Rowe's foundation, if you've kind of, you know, I've been around these guys, electricians and plumbers, everyone has a dearth. There's a dearth of, or there's a such a need for the trades, welders, all these guys. I've never met a woodworker. I've never met a stonemason, landscape company, a plumber who isn't looking for an apprentice, someone to go up through the journeyman, except there's formal apprenticeships and then there's informal. Mine's an informal apprenticeship. But I look at it as a service, because what are these guys being offered? Not much. And I can't do 40, but this year I'm able to bring mine up to 4. So I'm bringing four apprentices on this year. Two of them are from the American College of the Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina. It's the first college of building trades. It's been around for a while, and it was built by craftsmen to bring the crafts back into kind of a formal education process. It's a 4-year program. They have they have woodworking, they have stone, so they have these different trades in there. So I've got two of their students. I reached out to them through Instagram.
Yeah, Insta.
Instagram, Facebook. I had 12 using the social media platforms, which was new for me. I'm in my first year of doing this.
And you were harassed into doing it, just to be clear.
Yeah, well, yeah, by my daughter and my wife. And then they had so much fun. It took them an hour to explain how to hashtag. I could not understand. I'm not kidding you. I could not understand what a hashtag was and how to utilize it. And they actually took a little video of me trying to explain it. But, you know, I finally got through that. And so I found Instagram to be this enormously awesome technology tool to connect with other craftsmen. I've had some possible job offers out of it, but I got 7 applications for the apprenticeships, hired 2 off there and 2 off Facebook, which I link up. And so in the idea of service, I'm trying to also serve this other sector, this emerging young people, and just push the messaging of, hey, anybody can kind of start an informal apprenticeship. And so I do it on Instagram and Facebook, and I just encouraging guys, just do some. My sons are in 2 apprenticeships with the blacksmiths and at the climbing gym. And the idea is just young people, young men, women, even if it's once a week or if it's 6 weeks, whatever it is, linking up with someone who's an established business who wants to start sharing knowledge or an opportunity, because it could be the spark that lights that kid's world up. Or they could say, hey, that was great, but I'm interested in this parallel universe over, you know, I could be doing stone and these guys could say, oh, I'm interested in woodworking. But I think in today's economy, it's critical, it's important, and there's a need for it. And there's so many openings, and no one's, you know, Mike Rowe has, his foundation has, I don't know what it's called, but they offer scholarships for apprenticeships. And I mean, how many people know about that?
Well, more people do now.
Well, yeah.
With the huge reach of the Mixed Mental Arts podcast, pretty much the whole world just got the memo.
Oh, okay.
So that's good. But that is part of what we want to do,
yeah,
is you're able to take on 4 apprentices. Mm-hmm. But what we want to do is really sort of gather together what are all those resources, what are all those opportunities, so that the path becomes clearer. And some of that is letting people know about programs that already exist, like Mike Rowe's program. Some of that is saying, hey, if you are, you know, like John, and you're out there and you want to take on apprentices and you want to find them, that we will, you know, create a forum on mixedmentalarts.co where it's easier for, you know, would-be apprentices and would-be masters, builders, to train those apprentices. And so we want this community to not just diffuse these ideas, but also help people get jobs, help people find practical ways to make a living, help people find a path.
Well, here's a hack to that too, because everybody's like, man, I can't do apprenticeship because I don't have the ability to take on an employee. You don't need to. James Altucher says the economy is going to be an employee-free economy soon, right? So what I do is, so I had 2 6-week openings, 2 12-week openings, and I might have another round of those. So I just I took the applicants who wants to just work 6 weeks, who wants to just work 12 weeks. So I have the work. I have the those who can come in and do the apprenticeships. And so instead of me have employees, I run them through payroll services in Truckee, California. So they're going to go through payroll. They're going to have all the proper, you know, they're going to get the taxes done. They're going to have workman's comp. You know, it's all legal, perfect. I don't have to create employees and then suffer through that process of having to hire a bookkeeper. And so it's a great way for guys who say maybe they're a woodworker and they have one guy in the shop and they need one more for 6 weeks. And if they find some guy, just run them through a staffing, local labor services. You know, I just say, hey, I've got someone who's going to contact you and they're going to work for me for 6 weeks. And then they make money. You make money. The guy gets an apprenticeship and everyone's covered without the stress of this idea of creating an employee-based business when, you know, the demand's not that, especially in our line of work. It's project to project. It grows. So I always have to adapt to each project. I have to build up a crew. I have a lot of repeats. But, you know, the thing I would encourage young people to do is reach out to them. My first one, Gilland, I didn't reach out to him. He reached out to me. He found me on a Google search and he wanted to do Drystone. I'm like, well, in 8 years or 10, 12 years, you're the second person to ever ask me for work. So I'm definitely going to keep you on my list. And then within 3 months, I had an opportunity to show up and I brought him in. Now he's on his second round with me. That's so great. You can also just, young people can also reach out to the craftsmen, whatever they're interested in, and ask.
Well, and I think that's something that students often don't appreciate is the power of a young person reaching out to somebody a little bit more experienced and saying, I want to learn from you.
Yeah.
And that applies if you're in high school and you actually take an interest in your teachers and say, hey, I really want to learn what it is that you know. Can you please teach me? Can you mentor me? Teachers, that's the experience that teachers dream of. Mm-hmm. That's like their crack. That's teacher crack, is a student who's actually really interested and really engaged and wants to learn. So if you do that, that's a huge thing. But you can also do that with someone like John Aguilar. People are doing it, in a misguided way with me.
Well, we did. Exactly. I mean, we're going to, too. So, you know.
So people will do that. And I think it's okay to ask. In the same way that it's okay to ask your teacher and say, excuse me, can I work for you? Can I learn from you? You can do that with anybody that you see out there in the world.
I think it's the secret weapon is just to go out and ask. I mean, my boys wanted to, I've got the Santa Barbara Forge and Iron guys doing all the bronze works for me. And my boys, I took them on a shop tour one day and they said, hey, can we work in there? And I said, I'll plant a seed in Dan's mind. And I asked Dan, are you open to this? And he's like, yeah. I said, okay, my boys have to do the work now. So they asked him, they emailed him, they followed up with him, they set up the schedule, and they've been doing it 4 months, and these guys, they're working on projects. Sometimes they're cleaning and sweeping and sorting. Other times they're doing fab work, or they're grinding or something. And I asked Dan recently after 3 months, I said, are they an asset or are they kind of just a nuisance? And he's like, no, bring them in every week. Cause they're doing two and a half hours each week each. And he's like, they're absolutely crucial. By the time I get there to pick them up, they're on their own in the back doing something that frees up some of his guys to do something more high end, more skilled requirement, you know? So, I mean, it was great. And he's, you know, he's thinking about doing it again for, you know, so they're going to be there for a total of, I think, 6 months. And so definitely ask. I mean, there's a lot of guys would love, and it is, you know, when these guys asked me, and Gillen asked me, it was pretty cool. I was like, wow. And so then I had to step up my game to be able to teach. And when, and I found, just like a lot of people say, when I teach, I learned a lot more. So that's true. You know, so it was beneficial both ways.
Yeah. And I wouldn't underestimate the degree to which that's possible. I mean, the guests that we've booked on Mixed Mental Arts, people are often mistakenly impressed. But that was a lot of that was just asking. You send them an email, you see what they say. And also I lied about how many listeners we had, and that helps too. But you probably don't have to do that. But even with, I mean, I was talking to Eli Harrigan, and we were talking about the possibility of doing a series of videos called, so there's Carol Dweck has this old joke, it's not research, it's me-search. And that's really, why does an academic devote their whole lives, a scientist spend their whole lives studying one little topic? And there's always something very personal and emotional from their childhood that set them off on that path. Mm. And so we were talking about doing a series of videos that where you would take each of these scientists and just find out, what's your me search? What's the thing that really set you on this particular path? And talking to you, I don't think that it necessarily needs to be just scientists. Like, it would be great to get a lot of different MeSearch stories of people in every field. What is it that inspired you to become this particular kind of chef? I would love to know Roy Choi, who did the Korean barbecue burrito.
Yeah.
I'd love to know more about his story. He has an autobiography.
Yeah.
But to have like just a tight piece of 5-minute video where people can get intrigued enough to then go read his autobiography, that would be great. I would love to do one for you. And I think what was interesting is that as I talked to Eli, he was like, do you think John Haidt would want to be involved? I was like, and then I sent Eli John Haidt's website, the Heterodox Academy, which is his attempt to create more intellectual diversity within academia. And Eli was like, that's a terrible website. And so even though John Haidt is brilliant and we love and adore John Haidt, he needs social media help. He needs website design help. And if anybody's out there and wants to help out John or wants to help out anyone and says, hey, John, let me help you redo your website. Let me help you do some video. Let me help you do some social media marketing to drive these ideas.
It's definitely a leap out there. And that's a leap. I had a website and I kept it up. And then I decided to do a business Facebook page and then link and Instagram because you can do both now. And I set a 1-year limit on the experiment. It worked so well. And so what we're doing now is we're going to the next level is we're going to document this project. We're going to have time lapse. We're going to have a professional photographer. We're going to do Instagram live videos of the project on a schedule. We're going to do, so I have this kind of social media team. But again, it's an experiment. It's like how, you know, a lot of guys who are dry stones, some of the best guys out there don't even have a website.
Yeah.
It blows my mind. I'm like, maybe the word of mouth is that, and they're just at a level they like, and that's cool. I'm a little bit more hungry than that, and so my whole thing is like, okay, we're in the oldest trade in the world. That's awesome, and now I'm going to marry that. You know, this kind of, I don't know if that's idea sex, but I'm going to marry that with Instagram live video on a schedule that people, because people love to see what I discovered. People love to see how things are built and done because they're so disconnected from. They're so disconnected from the process anymore. Everything comes ready, done. It's in Sunset Magazine. It's finished. And I get more people want, they love seeing videos of the before, during, especially, you know, the guy's hands chiseling away at something or how we do saw cuts to achieve a curvilinear or radial cut. How do we set a 500-pound stone up without a machine, you know? And so they love that. So we're going to marry on this project is three social media accounts, YouTube. We're going to upload everything, and then we're going to have the live, and then we're going to have time-lapse photography. It's designed to, one, drive more business, but also to just show this to the world. And in the end, it's really coming down to creating more love for stone and more love for proper stonework, because that's, in the end, that's the thing that bugs me the most is the ignorance about how stone's supposed to be used, and then our competitor products like El Dorado. You know, it's this phony stone. It's puffy concrete.
Yeah.
You know, and they market themselves as the most believable stone or something like that, but it's not. And what happens is there's all these like this fakery out there, and there's it's subtle, it's sexual, it's seductive, and these great photos, and people are putting up these sheets of fake stone with grout onto the little wall, and when it's all done, it looks good for about an hour, and then there's no magic to it. And I guess it really bugs me because it's sold as proper, it's sold as structural, it's sold to me, it's honestly, there's this guy, George Gonzalez, I think he's in Petaluma, and I read a quote by him, he's a dry stone guy, he said, it's a sin when you sell something as structural stonework, but it's not. And I love that quote. So
it sets off your hinky meter.
Oh, big time.
And it sets off my hinky meter. One of the things that drives me nuts is a lot of people can't tell the difference between an education and indoctrination. And an education is drawing the person out so they can think for themselves. And it's fundamentally about the teacher disempowering themselves, humiliating mm-hmm. themselves to build up the student. And the indoctrination is the opposite. You are putting into doctrine and you're belittling the student to make yourself feel more powerful. And that sets my hinky meter off drives me nuts. And there are a lot of people who do it. And most people can't really, in the same way that they can't tell the difference between, you know, the fakery and the real deal. And part of what I want to do with this podcast is empower people to help tell the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah.
And I think as we grow and as we evolve this podcast, it's going to be great to show people the difference between the wheat and the chaff, not just in an education and ideas, but in what is, you know, real stonework look like versus the fakery. Brian, I know, will be strongly invested in helping people spot good wines from bad wines. Mm-hmm. That will mm-hmm. be his personal domain. The cheese, he's going to do a mm-hmm. lot of work on cheese and the different kinds of cheeses. So whatever it ends up being. But I think what's so great about MMA, mixed martial arts, is that there is no opportunity for fakery. Because if you're full of shit, it becomes very obvious in the ring. And in so many other domains, like education, stonework, it's often, it takes a lot. You have to be, essentially, your mind is the octagon.
Yeah, I mean, you think about when it first came out, I was in my second round of the military when it started. That was 90s, like 97, and it really started being shown on TV. And those guys versus now, what is that, 16, 17, 30, 20 years later? Are you talking about discipline? Capacity, skill is just off the charts compared to the original MMA.
Yep.
And so it's kind of the same thing as like, just, you know, this is a little sliver of what I can do. And if there's this collective effort with artisans and craftsmen, I mean, the idea is that, you know, when you're talking about indoctrination versus education is that you bring in the apprentice, you're trying to find the guy who's going to outdo you and who's going to carry this forward. And that's really what the mindset. And so the elders, those of us, you know, I'm 47, so who are doing this and plying away at this, not only are we trying to better ourselves, but we should be trying to find and offer up the opportunity for the next group of young people who will come and outdo us. I mean, that is the, and if you get that, it's actually a beautiful thing. You don't have to get all egotistical about it.
Yeah, and it gets you out of your own way. And there's a great line, I think it was from one of the painters like Michelangelo or Da Vinci, and he said, "It is a poor student who does not outdo his master." Mm. If you aren't surpassing the current best practices, then you're not doing your job. You should be always trying to figure out. So it's this very interesting dance where you are learning and absorbing everything you can from as many different people as possible. So you're having as much idea sex as possible with the view to then channeling that into your work to figure out how to outdo your master in time.
There's one more point you just kind of made me remember I'd like to talk about. In this world like of collaboration, I think it was so important, especially in the States, because I've lived, you know, I lived in Israel, I lived in Bosnia, I've been to all these different countries. And one thing I think it's important, and I got to this point, and we were talking about it earlier, checks and balances. So when I created the consortium, I'm like, I started thinking like, who's going to want to join me in this vision and how? When most guys are very sovereign oriented, their sovereignty as a craftsman, as a small business, you know, most of these guys are one man, my stone importer is a one man show, the blacksmiths are maybe five guys, the woodworker is one and a half, you know, and we thrive on our sovereignty and our independence and our individuality and the fact we're not some big company and we're just pushing, you know, paper and running employees, right? And so what I came up with was two things is, When I started the consortium, I looked up the Latin meaning of consortium is perfect, is, you know, multiple entities join forces for a project. You know, sometimes it's just there for a certain lifespan, then it goes away. So I said, okay, that's going to be the structure. And then how do I message or how do I ask these guys? So I said, listen, I respect your sovereignty in your trade. All I'm asking you is to join forces for this project. We have no legal paperwork, no business structure. It's a working name only. And I said, you know, there's no requirement and there's no requirement to stay. And so everybody, when I really acknowledged and used the word that maintaining your sovereignty and that we're all going to collaborate and there's only going to be one of each trade in this consortium, that was a big plus. But the thing that I had to do, this is part of self-reflection, refinement, etc. I said, how do I, what checks and balances system? So what I did is I structured it so I don't have the typical general contractor set up where you take in. Typically, a general contractor will run a project. All the subcontractors will give a bid. They'll mark their bid up, right? 15%, whatever it is. They'll submit that to the client, and then they make money off all those guys. So they're subcontractors. So you have this kind of status, right? Well, it also eliminates the true dynamic of what the possibility of what a consortium is, you know, that adjacent possible that or that we talked about. And so what I did, I set up on this project that I don't make any money off anybody that works with me. I only make money off the agreement I made with the contract for me and the work I actually do. And so the checks and balances is that every guy I bring in, the blacksmith, the woodworker, whoever, I can look at them honestly, and if I say, hey, we got to drop 10,000 off that or whatever it is, or we got to hustle up, they know that I'm not doing it with money signs in my eyes on them because I'm not making any money. All we are is I'm just directing the project flow. They're part of it, but they're an equal. And some of my best ideas come, or the best refinement of my stonework comes off maybe the lighting guy or someone in another trade. So it's a real constant dynamic of collaboration. But the key is to, when you do that, you have to do it with a level of equality and respect of the other guy's sovereignty, and then probably not put yourself in a position where you're going to be able to make money off them. That's just me personally, because I'm like, where does that end? If I'm making money off all these guys, how do I check that? And I decided not to even go there.
So you've put yourself, what you're talking about is, in order to enable the wisdom of crowds, you have to check your own power.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to make sure that you're not in a position to have power over others.
Yeah. And it's, and again, that's a very seductive thing to do. But when you project it out to what your true goal is, mine is to build the most beautiful things I can imagine with the best people. And that's like my primary mission is beautiful structures and features. Well, that trumps all that, right? And then I realized, like, making a bunch of money and having that go away is not what I'm after. I'd rather just have a good, solid living that I can work with my family and have these amazing people. And so the reward of this collaboration already, and we're 9 months into it, is fantastic. I mean, the outcome and these people I get to work with. But it is, it's really articulating that in your own mind that I'm going to limit. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Like, no, I think that's excellent. I mean, that's very much, there's a great Emerson quote, I think it is, that in every work of genius, we hear our own thoughts reflected back to us with a certain alienated majesty. And as you talk about all of this, this is what I want to do with Mixed Mental Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And my concerns are, they're not financial. And they are, I know that it's specifically incredibly important that I not be in a position of power over this thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that Brian and I not be in a position of power of all of this thing, so that I can be checked, I can be told when I'm having bad ideas, and I do that. And so that what you're doing is you're empowering everybody to step forward and everybody to contribute and throw their own things into the mix. So that what we're doing is that everybody feels comfortable putting their best foot forward and isn't worried about who am I going to be screwed here? What's going on? What is the intent here?
Because you don't want people holding back. That's
exactly
the key. And so, you do have to structure it so there's no exit the wrong way.
That's right.
And then there's a constant messaging. And so everyone's got the message from me, and my client even knows. He knows that when I present these guys' contracts to him, that I'm not marking up anything. We have full transparency, and I love it. Transparency is a great, it's a relief. It's a relief to be transparent because you don't have to play these shuck and jive, you know.
Well, it's emotionally exhausting to try and deceive other humans.
Mm-hmm.
Like, lying is hard
work.
That's
true, yeah, yeah.
It takes a lot of work, and then ultimately you're worried about being caught. And the realities in the modern age are probably going to be caught at some point. So why do the dance?
Exactly.
And we're going to have to figure out what are the mechanisms of transparency within Mixed Mental Arts. There's obviously emotional transparency in terms of saying how we know what we know, knowing what we don't know. That's a part of it. And then at some point when there's actual money, there will have to be some sort of financial transparency where people can see how the money is coming in, where it's going, what it's being channeled to, and you know, how much of it is going on to Brian's cheese budget, which is going to be like a big line item.
Big one.
Probably 90% of revenue goes into cheese for Brian.
It's also new. These are just new ways of doing business in an era when, I mean, you look at what's happening. And just the profit motives with, you know, shareholder based companies. People are sick and tired of being sick and tired, but a lot of people aren't finding or creating a way out. And I don't have an answer, but this is just my answer to my own little tiny sliver.
But the interesting thing is that you say that these are new ways, and you're saying you don't have an answer. But these are very old ways. This is how a tribe is organized. Mm. A tribe is organized where there's a distribution of power.
I see,
You know, it's not necessarily that anybody is in charge. And I mean, you know, Chris Ryan in particular does such a good job of sort of challenging what our assumptions are about tribal life. And it's egalitarian, it's communitarian, does not mean there are no disagreements.
Yeah.
You know, people all the time are pissed off with each other and saying what other people aren't doing. That's why we have those emotions. And so that's going to be the great fun and the great game of the improv of what you're doing with your consortium. What we're doing with Mixed Mental Arts is that we're going to have disagreements.
Yeah.
And we're going to challenge each other, and we're going to push each other. And it's just going to be a constant process of a just fire.
Yeah. There you go. And then I think it's just an unused muscle of how to sort out disagreements. We've created all these contexts and structures where no one has to, if you disagree with someone, you just exit out.
Yeah.
But when you're on a big project like this, or you're in this fixed setting with with these parameters, you have to sort it out. And it's just an unused muscle.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, this isn't something we can't handle. And so we just have to grow back into it. But it is like a tribe. I guess that's a great way, because there's about 22 of us total on this thing.
And what you're talking about is you're talking about trust. And that's, how do you build trust? You build trust with transparency. That's how you build trust in a marriage and a relationship and any working relationship. You're just like open. You admit when you fucked up. You move on. You learn. You adjust fire. You embrace the suck when the time comes from that. You celebrate the victories.
You're using all of them, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm going to steal. I mean, it's funny. Brian Atoya, who's been doing a lot of the website work and is starting to do some of the marketing work, he had called me yesterday an idea pirate, or here you have steal like an artist. And the more you understand that, there's the question of, do ideas belong to people? Which I don't, I like what Jefferson said, which is that an idea is, you know, like a candle. It's when I light your candle with my candle, my world doesn't get less bright.
No,
it gets more bright.
I'm an idea. I'm James Altucher has this exercise: write 10 ideas down a day, and then marry the ideas. Right? I don't do them every day, but I have ideas. I just recently threw 2 ideas out to other people because I can't. There's an opportunity to go teach the Syrian refugees in the island of Lesbos in Greece. Dry stone works because there's about 65,000 of them stuck there, and there's this, I think it's an Italian organization that's teaching like some. We'll just say trades. They're teaching them some self-sustainable work so they can start kind of making this place that they're going to be there for a long time. So through these group of people, I was asked to come over and do this. I can't do it this year, so I've handed that idea off to another dry stone person, hoping they'll do it with some support and input from me. And so, you know, I think, and then the ideas I've had, I share them freely with the members of the consortium. They enhance them. So there's some of them have gone 6 levels higher than my initial seed idea. So I've learned to just let the seed idea go, because always going back to what's the final mission, what's the goal, is the highest level of beauty we can build. So that doesn't mean my idea is the highest. Sometimes it is. A lot of times it's input, input, input. Then we get 6 layers out. Boom, we achieve the highest possible. And then... when you get there and all you do is just change your perceptions and your idea of ownership and ego, it becomes this beautiful, there's a beautiful synergy there. And so some of us are more idea generating, you know, and some people are less, but some people refine. So I think
part of that though comes down to getting over that preciousness where my dad said something to me a long time ago, and like many things my father has said, it's taken me a decade or more to understand what he was actually talking about. But he, you know, just understanding that you're never going to have a shortage of ideas.
Yeah.
There's no shortage of ideas. You're going to have lots and lots and lots of them. So don't get precious about them. And by the way, there's such a tendency to become precious about the ideas where you don't want to necessarily give them away, because what if that's worth something? Mm-hmm. Or you're like, oh, I'm going to give you this idea, but I want to in some way try and ensure that I'm going to get money back for this idea.
Yeah.
But that's not actually really how human dynamics work. So, you know, you say the idea to someone and you've given them the idea, and then let's say that they take that idea, they run with it, they have a bunch of success with it. Well, this is where reciprocal altruism comes in. That person is also a human being, and they're going to go away, and it's going to nag at them that they've had this success off of this idea that you gave them. And so they're going to want to try and figure out some way to pay you back. And they might bring you on to some project, or they might try and work in, and it might not pay off for 5 or 10 years, or they may just go around and just talk about what a great guy you are because you did them this huge solid, and it will pay off in all sorts of ways. And at a tribe, at the level of a tribe with 150 people, that reciprocal altruism is, because it's within our Dunbar number, it's fairly easy to track.
Yeah,
and in a world of 7 billion people, it really is so much more of a leap of faith, where you know some people are going to fuck you. That's going to happen, and that's going to happen because they have their own issues and their own internal issues. But in general, you know, if you are generating those ideas, you're borrowing ideas from wherever, you're crediting people, then those social dynamics will ultimately work out in your favor. Because there are these inbuilt principles, these inbuilt impulses of reciprocal altruism, gratitude, fairness, reciprocity, that will ultimately redound to your benefit.
And when you practice, when you exemplify that yourself, or you practice that yourself, those people that come into your little sphere, this is what I found. I mean, this is like real life experience for me. They tend to gravitate towards that and become that. So the members of my consortium are just some of the most awesome, honest, capable people, always shooting me ideas. So my lighting designer is the one who gave me the idea of changing my title from Dry Stone Mason, which always generated the wrong questions. And I was trying to figure out for years how to, because the Mason brought me into the questions, do you do brick? Do you do veneer? Do you do facade? And I don't do any of that stuff. And he said, how about calling yourself a stonesmith, Craig Peterson? And I'm like, whoa. And this was like 1 year ago. I looked up the etymology, Old English and German of Smith. And I realized that's actually for what I want to do, or how the direction I want to take my craft. It's actually a perfect word. I don't know anybody that says stonesmith. Someone's going to go out there and say that. And that's fine. I mean, any other guy who's a dry stone mason, that's a great term. And so that was his idea, and he gave that to me, handed that to me freely. I took it, and it has had a massive effect on the questions asked of me by people. Much more intelligent questions, leading up to much more intelligent conversations, and not a lot of retraction. Like I don't have to steer people away from the wrong field. They're asking an open question rather than, do you do something I don't even touch? Does that make sense?
Even absolutely, and I mean, even if, let's imagine that everybody, you know, the word stonesmith now goes nuts, and there are all these people who are using stonesmith. Well, now you're the guy who popularized the term,
and t-shirt,
and you guys, do you hear that Team Unicorn? Who do they? But they, and Craig is who they have to attribute
Craig,
for this one.
Craig Peterson.
Okay, so but now you're gonna have to. I guess I'm an idea smith.
Yeah,
you know that's.
I love the word. Yeah.
But it is that idea of craftsmanship. But even if those terms become massively popularized, it's not necessarily a problem for you. It could actually be really, mm-hmm. really good for you because you're the pioneer of that. Mm-hmm. So I think in general, so much of this comes down to, I made a decision when I first started tutoring about how I was going to approach my day job. And my day job hasn't really changed in the last 13 years. But because I have been constantly trying to improve it, it has given my life meaning and purpose, because that's how I chose to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what's great about this conversation is we have two very different occupations,
yep.
but we're approaching them in very much the same way. And whether it's sushi or being a stonesmith or being a sushi smith, a stonesmith or an idea smith, you can really be or a t-shirt smith.
You just put Smith for the
Smith.
T-shirt.
Smith.
blank line Smith.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What kind of Smith are you?
Yeah.
But whatever it is, you can be a Smith in anything. Mm-hmm. And you can approach it with that sort of craftsman mentality of constantly trying to improve. And I think that's a pretty good way to button this all up.
Yeah.
So John Aguilar. Oh, we should end. There is one other thing that I did want to briefly open up.
What's that?
Which is your cultural confession.
So give me a primer on that.
So the primer is, what culture were you born into and did you grow up in?
Oh, so I grew up in Indiana, middle of Indiana. I was the son of a fundamentalist Baptist preacher. That was tough.
How was that?
It was, you know, be honest, it was a... I hated my childhood. I hadn't, for the first 19 years, until I went in the Marine Corps. Marine Corps was strangely my salvation. It was I don't really, other than my sister, I don't have any connection with that world anymore. It was brutal. It was smothering, suffocating. The dogma and the ideology of the fundamentalists, especially the Baptists. I even went to Bob Jones University for one semester. That's the most extreme kind of Christian university in the world. It's out in South Carolina. But it was, the way I describe it. But here's the great thing. So I've gone through all the grieving process. You know, I was abused till I was 17, all these types of things that fundamentalists, especially in that part of the world, and Baptists in particular, do, because they believe you're born a sinner. They believe you must be molded in the image of God. How they do that is kind of based on the church or what the parents think. And it's not a fun childhood. However, what I realized about, probably 6 years ago, I have this incredibly vivid imagination. I mean, like, I go into sites, my Moongate project, when I walked onto that blank space, it almost came to me in a sudden moment, right? And I have this very visual dream world. I'm incredibly imaginative, visual. And what I did probably up till I was 17 years old, is I practiced what I now know to be a lot of cognitive dissonance, is I had to check out. I had to check out of the five times a week. I went to Christian schools. I had to check out of this monotonous world. And the way I did that is I daydreamed. So now what I look at is my upbringing was the biggest gift, because I created this neural, this network in my head, this brain capacity to be highly imaginative, highly visual, and daydream. And daydreaming is how I come up with a lot of my ideas.
Mm.
And so I now look back on just the overarching theme in my life with gratitude. I don't have gratitude for the individuals involved, but I have gratitude for that whole thing, because I wouldn't be where I'm at as a stonesmith doing something I love, building beautiful stuff, without that kind of foundation that came through this strange way. But I had to really do a lot of mental tricks and reversals and counter moves to come to that thought. And then when it made sense, like, oh, this is the gift, then I was able to just switch that in my head and look at it differently. But that was my framework. And then I went into the military, and then I thought I was going to be a career military guy. And I fell into this when I was 30, 36, 35 by accident.
So you've really made kintsugi. There are all these broken pieces of your life, this fundamentalist Baptist upbringing, the Marine Corps, traveling all over the place, and then all these books that your wife has handed you.
Lots of books.
And from all of that, you've pieced together something beautiful. You've filled in the mm-hmm. cracks with gold.
Yeah. And then obviously having a family drives that. It's probably the biggest driver in my life, is how do I exemplify for them constant growth, learning, love of learning, just like you teach. Like, we're we're always, everybody's consuming books in the house. So it's not just we're teaching them, we're trying to exemplify flaw with flaws, obviously, but also, you know, that you don't have to, you can fix, adjust, fire, and refine even in your 40s, even yeah. in your 50s. I think it's great for the kids to see, but they drive that. They're my primary motivation, as is the same for a lot of parents, you know? So it's
doesn't
cool.
get much more primal than that.
No. And there's, I mean, yeah. And when you talk about the tribe, the most primal aspect of the tribe is that little family unit. So.
Yeah. So where can people find you, John Aguilar, in your many social media outlets? Where should they look?
Well, we'll have it up on the, we'll have it on the, okay. On so my website is heritageearthandstone, all spelled out, .com. The consortium website is throughstonegroup.com, and that's THROUGH, throughstonegroup.com. Instagram is John Aguilar, JonAguilar _ DesignWorks. We'll have that up. And Facebook is Heritage Earth and Stone page.
That's great. So you can look in all of those places. That's a lot of social media presence, but you deserve it. You yeah. deserve it. And also, I think, John, you are going to be blogging at mixedmentalarts.co, giving people some direction on, A, some of your own journey, your favorite books, yeah. and then also talking about some resources for finding apprenticeships.
Yeah, I'll put on there. I'm going to put a link to American College of Building Arts. I've talked to the Dean Simeon, and he's the one that helped. He's going to let their students go about a week early to do the apprenticeship. So I've been talking to him. I'll put that link up. I'll put what I call my top 7 book or blogs. In the book, so I'll put a hyperlink on there, a couple other things like that. And these are all just my basic tools that got me here.
And if you're out there and you're listening and you want apprenticeships or you want to have apprentices, wherever you are, and again, I think a great way is either you can reach out to us and we'll help you find people in the community, or alternatively, just contact random people directly. And I think a great skill exchange for young people to masters is offer to help them with social media, you know, and just ask to learn the trade and the craft in return. And that's a great skill exchange where everybody can really be benefiting.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, ladies and gentlemen. Always a pleasure to be in the dojo with you guys. And check out mixedmentalarts.co. Maybe get a t-shirt with either what we already have up or one of John's great sayings, because I think he came up with pretty much a whole new fall wardrobe.
It's going to be awesome.
It's going to be amazing.
All right.